to suck. And this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on patreon.com/FUNetworkTV and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. Drop us a few bucks. Don't be a freeloader. And now, here's your show.
Hey, Canada, welcome to episode 18 of Matter of Fact. I'm Ishat Reza.
And I'm Professor S. Let's get started.
Today on Matter of Fact, we're going to be talking about systemic racism and whether we've reached a turning point. Professor S., what is your take on why we're at this point and kind of what got us to having such extreme conversations about the issue of race?
I think from a very general point, I think that barrier or that wall is now being totally kicked down, right? We can't hide behind not wanting to talk about these things. I've talked to a couple of my friends, when we were watching CNN, Cornel West mentioned that the reason why people are now prepared to engage this and why you can no longer ignore systemic racism in society, whether judicial system, whether policing, education, is because we essentially saw a lynching on TV. We saw a man pleading for his life. We saw a police officer acting quite nonchalantly, and it's in our face, right? It's there.
Yeah. And what you're referring to, because unfortunately there've been a number of incidents, even in the last couple
right.
of weeks,
mm-hmm.
is
George Floyd.
The knee on the neck of George Floyd. Exactly. Yeah.
Correct. We're talking about that. And from my perspective, when I watch that, my insides just twist because it's a reminder that this happens every day. And we're so capable of, compartmentalizing and not even thinking about these things. Because you can say, well, whatever, it doesn't happen to me or I haven't seen it. So we're not sensitized, but now we are. Right? The walls are gone and we've seen this happen and we've heard mm-hmm. many stories, Mr. Garner, in Staten Island, who said, I can't breathe. He was killed by police officers too. And that wasn't enough. And then we can go back to Rodney King and we see the beating that was taken 30 years ago. That wasn't enough. But now we've seen somebody killed. And now we've seen that this is I hate to say it like this, but this seems like a standard operating procedure on how to mm-hmm. treat people, and especially people that are a visible minority or African Americans or indigenous, from what we've been hearing the last couple of weeks. It's just it's just crystallizing for everybody now. You can ignore it, but there's one of two things if you ignore it. You're either extremely racist or you're extremely awful and you don't want to think about it, right? But
I agree that, I think part of the issue is that right now, and especially in the last, several years, because of social media, we don't have any interlocutor necessarily between us and what's happening. So it's not like
Correct.
We're just reading it on the news or
right.
what they've reported to us or whatever. Like, there's no filter.
Right.
So people are taking like raw video and posting it online, and then we're watching what's happened. And even though I do know that, there are some people who actually feel really hurt by seeing images like that, who are, members of the African American community or the Black
right.
community or
yeah.
the Indigenous community, it's hard for them to see people of, that they can relate to in terms of these are my family members or
mm-hmm.
people like my family members or, to constantly see this stuff and be bombarded with it, that it can be hard for them. But I think in a sense, because the general population has been exposed to the brutality that's existed already,
right.
like for decades and decades and decades,
mm-hmm.
and in some cases, hundreds of years. But,
yes.
it's that now people are seeing it. And I think the people who are reacting to it, it's one of two ways, right? So one is people are saying, okay, this is shocking, right? Like this,
yes.
I cannot believe that this is how it is. And I think for those people, it was sort of like blissful ignorance in a
mm-hmm.
sense. Like it was like, they just weren't aware of it or they just couldn't imagine it because they didn't see it. It didn't affect them on a day-to-day basis. It didn't necessarily affect people in their circle. It didn't affect their family members
right.
in quite the same way as it has people of, indigenous or black or other people of color type backgrounds. So for them, it was like an ignorance. And I think there, you know, I think in a way it's good in a, that they're aware of it now, because they should be outraged. We should all be outraged. We should always have been outraged, right? But that awareness, I think, is good. But you do get the others, because recently, with the video from Canada, Alberta, of Chief Alan Adam,
yes,
being basically bulldozed by a police officer and really quite manhandled, mm-hmm. For a violation of, you know, like an expired license plate or something like that. Like just the disproportionate use of force in yeah. that particular incident. You see the reaction of certain people who are just justifying it. They're saying, oh no, but the chief was, did you not see the first part of the video? The chief was, you know, he was like picking a fight. Like he wanted a fight. He took his jacket off. He, you know, and it's like, no, actually you missed the part where the chief was upset about the fact that he perceives a continuous harassment, like a constant harassment, like over and over again.
Right.
This is not his first interaction with the police. Right. And it's not because it's necessarily his fault. It's because the police disproportionately have interactions with members of the Indigenous community.
Yes.
And so his frustration comes from a long history, both personal and those of people in his community, where they've had this kind of interaction that's always been negative, that's always been disproportionate. And that's where his frustration comes from. But there are a lot of people who are in denial about it, even those who saw that video. There are people like going after anyone, you know, like myself or whoever who was tweeting about it in a negative way, like against the police, but they're justifying it. And, you know, like it just shows that there are two kinds of responses, right? Like there are those who will still be in denial over it and think that, well, it was perfectly justified, right? And then there are those who are now waking up to the fact that, yeah, you know what, this brutality exists and it is disproportionately affecting people of certain communities.
Well, there's also those who don't even know it exists, but it still goes on, right? I mean, we could look at the response of the RCMP regarding these, where they came out with a statement saying that there is a, in quotes, unconscious bias with respect to how First Nations, Indigenous people in Canada are treated by the police. Whereas the Prime Minister comes forth and says, no, it's systematic discrimination. So on the one hand, you have the Prime Minister of the country saying, no, it's systematic discrimination. And you have the RCMP stating it's an unconscious bias. And that's a big disconnect,
and when
right?
you say the RCMP, you're talking about initially the Commissioner of the RCMP and then the Deputy Commissioner in Alberta.
Correct.
Were both kind of like, you know, not sure about what systemic racism was and kind of claiming that, well, no, it's not systemic racism. It's this unconscious bias thing, or, you know, sure, we have some bad apples, but, you know, overall, the work of the RCMP is so great and whatever. And it's like, no, you're not getting it, right? And I think what was interesting there was a huge backlash against that, especially with the backdrop of, you know, the video that surfaced with Chief Adam.
Yes.
And so after the backlash, you know, within a couple of days, suddenly both the deputy commissioner and the commissioner are admitting that, yes, no, there is such a thing called systemic racism. And, you know, the RCMP is part of that problem.
But how they would even get to the position saying that's an unconscious bias when there is decades upon decades of factual data and historical record of the RCMP acting disproportionately against Indigenous people is incredible, right? So that shows
there's a complete blind spot in the system. A blind spot in the system, but also in the leadership. And that,
right,
to me, is the issue. I actually don't think that it's sufficient for the top brass of the RCMP to come out, you know, a couple of days later, mm-hmm. when they realize, oh, this is a big PR thing, like a PR problem for them, to come out and say, actually, no, like, we acknowledge systemic racism exists. Well, mm-hmm. too bad. You know what? Like, it's too late. And I just don't think they have the credibility anymore, or the public confidence for us to believe that, you know what, they're the right people to lead us through change. Mm-hmm. Because I do believe that the Prime Minister is sincere when he says that, you know, that we have a problem in Canada, that we have systemic racism, that we need to do something about it. Mm-hmm. I believe he believes that something needs to be done. It'll be interesting to see what they actually do. Like the body cameras, okay, that's one step, but to me, that's not really the big solution. Like, there has to be more to it, and they've acknowledged that there will be more to it. But I think there needs to be an overhaul of the system, and especially the RCMP. They have this huge, long history. And in order to do this overhaul, you have to have people at the top who genuinely get it. And I don't think, based on the comments of the two leaders of the RCMP who've spoken recently, that they're the right people for the job. So I think that should change. Like, they need to clear out the top brass and bring people in who really get it. I guess the challenge is finding people from within the RCMP who get it. So I don't know if there's someone from somewhere else who, you know, would be capable of leading the RCMP and also who get it. But that, to me, is the ideal next step.
No, there's also a case to be made where policing has changed so dramatically, and the nature of the response in which the police respond, I beg your pardon, to an incident and whatnot has changed. And they're simply not trained. And I think there's enough data to prove this. They're simply not trained to handle every type of situation that they're confronted with, right? So I'll pull up one here that goes to show how, in many instances, the police are totally unprepared for a situation, and you may want to have different stakeholders or different people involved in the response when somebody calls 911, for example. So the gentleman, DeAndre Campbell, who was shot and killed, he is a young man who lived in Brampton with his family. He called 911, I beg your pardon, on himself. He wanted to be taken to hospital. He had schizophrenia. He was on record. There was a file on him about this. He'd called 911 four to five times in the past, and this was a plea for help, right? So two officers arrived. Long story short, we don't know the full details yet, but a stun gun was used, guns were discharged, and the young man died. And this was for a mental health case, right? And so the question now is, why weren't social workers sent to these scenes with the police, right? Yeah. The police are not social workers.
No, that's right. I mean, that's an interesting point. And I wonder, maybe this highlights sort of like a decentralization issue too, from police force to police force, because I'm not sure if there's consistency, because I am aware that the Halton Regional Police in Ontario, that when they get these mental health calls, they actually have an emergency crisis unit that includes, so they have officers, but they have a social worker who's an employee of the Halton Police who goes with them. And so their approach, so it looks like they actually have training. So in this particular police force, they have the training,
right?
And so they probably have better outcomes as a result. I'm only aware of one situation that they were involved in, and it did work well. They did handle the situation with the kind of sensitivity and knowledge that you would expect of people, who have this kind of a role.
Right.
But what you're describing, and similarly, the case of Regis Korchinski Paquet, her, it was the same thing. There was a call made that had to do with it was like a wellness check, and then the next thing we know is that she's fallen off the balcony somehow and to her death. And I guess the full details will come out when the investigation is complete, but to me, that should not be the outcome a call for a wellness check. And the issue here is it's people of color, and Black people, Indigenous people, who are disproportionately having negative interactions and outcomes when it comes to their interactions with the police. And that's the issue, right? Because you'll certainly get those, I've seen it on social media where they're like, oh, but like the police are brutal to white people too. And it's kind of like, yes, it's not right for anyone to face brutality from the police. But the point is, it's the disproportionate nature of interaction, like negative interactions that people, who are Black or Indigenous and other people of color have with the police. That's the issue, right?
Yep.
So there's the police side of things, and we've seen a lot of cases recently around that. But it also extends to other parts of society, right? One of the things that I think you and I have some direct experience with is, say in the academic world or in the legal profession, and, other places where you don't see a lot of people who are minorities represented in institutions that have power. And also, like, you know, in places where you have the ability to influence a lot. So for example, in academia, right, like you're dealing with students and you are coming across people from all walks of life who eventually are going to go into different fields and so on. And you have the ability to influence people and to sure. share your experiences and to teach them in certain ways. And if everybody who teaches you, because I think back to when I was in university 20 years ago, mm-hmm. or maybe even a little bit longer than that, you know, the vast majority of my professors in Canada and in the US were all white men, the vast majority of them. There were some women, but thinking back to that period, not many minorities were professors. Not really, not many.
No, for me, that was, yeah, I mean, I'll go back 1997 when I started undergrad.
You're a bit younger than me.
Well, not that much younger, believe me.
Yeah, but yeah, I think we went around the same time.
Yeah, so 97, I remember the school I went to. They were primarily all white men, yeah. The only visible minority men or women that I have were in my science programs. In chemistry yeah. and calculus, there's your stereotype right there. But the first time yeah. I had a teacher that was not white in my actual field was in third year when I was taking a US politics class with an African American. So that was the first time. But yeah, you're right. And when we yeah. talk to students, we ask them, you know, I typically ask, what's the one thing that you'd like to see more of? And they always, to a T, come back and say, well, how come the classes are so diverse, but the faculty are not? Yeah. And that bothers a whole range of students. And I typically ask them, like, why does that bother you? It's yeah. you're being taught, no, we want a diverse presentation of views. We want to hear from yeah. different people. Everybody can explain something with a little different nuance or different approach based on your life experiences.
And I think that's the point. It's the lived experience of people of different backgrounds
yeah.
that can bring different issues to light. So I think, so it's not to say that, you know, we need to have diversity just because it looks better,
no.
but it's really like substantively, there is a difference, right? People will come with their different lived experiences. So someone like you who does work in a university environment, you know, I think you're going to be able to speak in from a very authoritative and unique position as a person who may have experienced certain forms of discrimination in his past
sure.
versus someone who is empathetic to the issue and is an ally and maybe has researched the issue, mm-hmm. but, you know, doesn't have that lived experience. So I think that's the point that we're making here, is that lived experiences are important. Everyone's lived experience is important. But right now we have a disproportionate representation of the lived experiences of white people, right? And so it's not to say that we don't want to hear any of that at all. Of course we do. But it's we also need to hear the lived experiences of other people who will face things that are a bit more unique to them, especially in the context in North America where we are the minority,
right.
You know, being a people of color, that our lived experiences need to be shared. And it's interesting, actually, I just, because in the legal profession, my world, you know, that's the problem. Like we have law firms, we have a lot of diversity now, like in terms of gender diversity, we have, you know, more and more people of color being represented in law firms, you know, but not that many people, again, from the Black community or the Indigenous community. They exist, but it's just not as, you know, as ubiquitous as you know, you have from other groups. And that is, it's a challenge because, you know, we want to have more diverse experiences represented in the legal profession, because these are the people who will be feeding into the judges.
Well, that's
something
that, yeah, that's something
right.
that came, like I've discussed with you in the past, and that's something I'm actually actively discussing with my students right now, is
yeah.
composition of the bench. Look at who our judges
yeah.
are, right? And
absolutely.
That's one of the things where if you scan the bench of the Supreme Court of Canada, you're not going to see much diversity there. And
well, you don't see any. I mean, you don't. I mean,
I'm being
not
kind.
You don't. Right. Okay. I mean, there are men and women on the bench now
right.
at the Supreme Court, which is positive. And it's been, you know, gradually it started to be that way since the mid 80s, and, you know, more and more now. And that's really good. Like, and it has made a difference, because when I was in law school, I actually did a paper on the impact of the female justices. And essentially, especially in the beginning, the fact that there were women justices actually led to more progressive outcomes on charter cases, on equality, like, for example, equality rights, yes, and then family law cases. So it was important to have that voice represented there. So similarly, it'll be important to have someone who's indigenous, at least someone who's indigenous, you know, someone who's black, someone who's a person of color. Like, these are other groups that need to be represented in the top court of the land, so that when you get issues relating to any kind of legal issue, really, because it affects all members of society, right, that you'll have decisions that come from people who've had diverse lived experiences. And I just, you know, I tweeted about this because it is, I think it's still shameful today that we have not yet had a single judge who's not white. Like, essentially, that's what it is. There's not a single judge on the Supreme Court of Canada who's not white.
I wonder how that works. I wonder what the data would be for federal appointed judges and at other levels, right?
It is better. Like, there are judges, you know, who are, like, there are black judges, there are indigenous people who are judges, there are other people of color who are judges, but, you know, we're far, like, few in between. Like, there's not that many. But we exist. But it's not just that, but even in the academic world, like in law schools, there is more diversity and so on. And actually, I would say that in terms of our Supreme Court appointments, I can think of, like, easily can think of at least one person of color who would be an amazing addition to the Supreme Court of Canada. And when his province's position, one of the, his province's positions became open, I was really hoping, you know, that he would make it onto the Supreme Court of Canada. And I don't know, like, you know, I don't know if he was part of the consideration process or whatever, but the point is there are some really brilliant people out there who would add much to the discussion and the diversity at the Supreme Court, you know, who have been overlooked or maybe for whatever reason have not been appointed, you know. And I brought this up actually with someone who I think would actually be great on the Supreme Court. And you know, his comment back to me was, you know, it's too easy to pay lip service to inclusive diversity while keeping all the power in the same hands, right? So, like, that is a position that I think is unfortunate, that even in 2020, you know, even with a government as liberal as Justin Trudeau's government, where they even had an Indigenous justice minister, that we still have not yet had a single non-white person appointed to the Supreme Court of Canada. I think that's shameful.
That reminds me the comment that you just made from the individual that you were talking to. I remember when I was going through my undergrad, I had the first African American teacher that I had. That was the same comment in terms of tone, right? Like, why it's why they're seeing such a low level of diversity in academia as well. And one of the things that he pointed to was the inability of the system to integrate different perspectives and include different perspectives. And for him, and this is going back to the point that you brought up, the whole concept of having people with different lived experiences. Because once you introduce that diversity of view, well, then your whole underlying system comes into question, right? The way you teach, the way you practice, because new views are being incorporated. So for that person, the issue was not necessarily being good enough to be part of the system, but the system actually being able to be flexible and responsive enough to include a broader range of views. And so that's where, for him, and as I've noticed, that's where, if you want to talk of terms like unconscious bias or anything as such, that's where the systemic discrimination or that glass ceiling or that barrier comes up, because it's an inflexible system. And I think that's what many people who, like, for instance, you brought up the comments of saying, well, he deserved to get beaten in terms of Chief Allen Adams, or even when you read some of the horrific comments involving the aftermath of George Floyd, where people are saying, well, you know, what are they really doing to deserve that treatment? That's a lack of perspective, right? That's a lack of, it's not even ignorance, it's a lack of perspective, because you don't have to encounter it, right? These and when you don't have, it's the same reason why I can't speak on behalf of anybody who's LGBTQ. I can't. I don't have that experience. But I can certainly be supportive, and I can certainly fight with those people to ensure that they get their rights and they're treated in a in line with how I expect to be treated, which is fair and equitably.
But see, that's why it's important to have that representation at the table as well, right?
Correct.
Because you're right.
Correct.
Like, we can be, the biggest allies of people, you know, LGBTQ people, but we don't have that lived experience. And so that's why it's important to have them at the table at, you know, whatever. So I think similar, like the things that we've mentioned in terms of representation at the various places, it applies to people with that lived experience as well, right?
No, it does. I mean, one of the biggest turning points for me in understanding other people's lived experiences is at where I work during Holocaust Memorial Week and Remembrance Week, they have a Holocaust survivor come and talk. And they also have a replica train carriage where the people of the Jewish faith were loaded into to be taken to the concentration camps. And for years and years and years, I was petrified to go to this because I knew what had happened. I'd studied the history, but I wasn't emotionally ready to view that. And then one of my students said, "You should come." And I went into that, you know, she called it a cattle car. So I went into it and it blew my mind. Then the following year, I went and listened. So this was just this past fall. I listened to a Holocaust survivor because I thought, if I'm going to do it, I have to do it now because there's not many left. And I need to hear what they have to say because we can say as much as we want, never again, or we will fight with you. But here's a living, breathing human being who can tell me what they went through. I sat there for an hour and a half listening to this proud man tell me how he looked in the face of evil and how his family was treated and how he came out the other side and all of the things that he's fighting for to this very day. And at that point, it clicked for me. And it clicked for me in the following sense. It's no good just saying that's racist. Right? It's no good just saying I don't agree with this discrimination. You now have to actively help and actively participate in helping to elevate marginalized or discriminated people so that you can try and break this vicious cycle because that's
voices.
What's going
on.
And their voices.
Yeah.
Because if you have the power for people to listen to you and you have beside you a voice that's trying their best and can't get traction, well, then it's on you to help them. Right? So it doesn't matter what the issue is. And so that's, I think, the great, you know, if there's going to be any benefit or any positive out of these videos being revealed to the world in their like naked horror, it's that people now know what it is. You can see it. You can feel the visceral pain of that individual, right? And that when you can relate to somebody's pain now and you can see that and you actually have a reaction, that's what's motivating people to get up. That's why you're having tens of thousands of people defying their own safety with COVID and going to march. Like, I wouldn't do that. Because
And I think actually the other part about these videos, I think that are powerful is in highlighting, you know what, we've talked a lot about the police brutality. And that is one sphere in which we have a huge problem. But also seeing the videos of, say, Amy Cooper or seeing what's happened with Jessica Mulroney to understand that, you know what, this also happens in a very normal, benign setting. So the Amy Cooper thing, you know, a black man was birding in Central Park. I mean, how many times have I been to Central Park and enjoyed the city and, you know, my surroundings and whatever, and never given it a second thought, yet this black man who's just doing his thing, birding, and he sees a lady who's not following the rules of the park, not having her dog leashed where he's supposed to be leashed, and just saying very politely to the person, "You need to leash your dog." And then she unleashes this nasty attitude and threat, you know, and she's somebody who I like, she's the type of person, you know, I've worked with someone like her before, right? Like highly educated, very polished otherwise, but has shown this ugly side of her where she so easily, just so easily jumped to, "I'm going to call the police and tell them that an African-American man is threatening me," right? Like just so easily, even though that was a blatant lie, and then to throw in about his race, she knew exactly what that was going to mean, you know, for him if the police did arrive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so that I think it's important for people to see that too, because yeah, you know what? Like your mild mannered, highly educated, you know, senior level colleagues in like all these you know, high office towers or whatever are just as susceptible to using their white privilege as you know, the police are to using their power against minorities. Right. And I think like even the case of Jessica Mulroney, same thing.
Oh,
like she was
God.
Doing the exact same thing. And she's someone who is in part, you know, known a little bit more apart from, you know, being Brian Mulroney's daughter-in-law or whatever. But known in part for being Meghan Markle's best friend in Canada. Right. And so it's like, oh, so you have a, you know, a biracial best friend, and yet you can still use your white privilege against
sure.
A black woman who you see as a threat and who you seem to think that her post, which was a very innocent and honest post where she's calling people, you know, to, you know, to stand up and support the Black Lives Matter mm-hmm. movement and say, you know, you should be supporting people when you have a platform, et cetera. She was saying it generally, but for some reason, you know, Princess Jessica Mulroney took it personally.
Oh, my Lord.
And then started... you know, and then started direct messaging with the other lady, the one who put the call out, and she's you know, a black lady,
yeah.
And started to, you know, harass her essentially by saying, well, you know, I've talked to people, companies and other people about you and, you know, how you're treating me unfairly and all this. And it's kind of like, what the heck, you know, what, why are you taking this so personally? And secondly, why are you trying to silence her? And I think she even made comments like, you know, why, like you think your voice is so important, but it's not, if you're not going to behave in a kind way or whatever. So it's like, oh, right. We forgot. Sorry. Us, you know, minorities have forgotten that you guys set the, you know, the standards for how we should be comporting ourselves. Right. Like it just like that whole mentality, is something that, you know what, we need to be aware of, that it exists among those who are our neighbors and our colleagues and,
yep.
you know, who you may otherwise not think are so-called, you know, quote unquote racist.
I mean, I heard about that and I didn't bother looking it up myself because I just thought, okay, am I going to get very annoyed reading this?
Mm-hmm.
and then I was told by a very trusted source in, you know, bullet points what happened. I rolled my eyes and just walked away. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's incredible, but you know, it's that whole expression, check your privilege, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how are you going to respond to a situation? And I think one thing that social media has done is it's good and a bad thing is at the same time, it truly lets you have an insight into how people truly are. Right? It
mm-hmm.
really does.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't just say, well, that really wasn't me. Well, it was you. You said it and you did it. So what is it? Right? So it's I mean, and to bring it full circle, you know, the first question that you started off with was, you know, why do I think this is such a moment in time, or is it a turning point? Like, how did this transpire? There's one thing that I neglected to bring up, which I think resonated a lot, especially in the United States after the death of George Floyd, and that's Martin Gugino. Do you know the name? He's the mm-hmm. Elderly gentleman in Buffalo.
75-year-old, yeah.
Now, there's an example of a white American being thrown to the ground and having his skull cracked open and bleeding from his
yeah.
ears. Yeah. Right. And then, you know, and so it brings it full circle where you're now saying, here is an ally being treated like this, and it's on TV and somebody has mm-hmm. taped it and you can see the blood mm-hmm. pooling on his skull. And that mm-hmm. also, I think, had a very resonating impact in the broader American society with the thinking, what just happened here? And I can't help but think that images like that also galvanize what you would call the silent support, right? I think that must have played a role.
Do you think that maybe that incident, like, okay, because I think for those, let's say, who maybe couldn't empathize with other people who are not of their same background
yep, yep.
being treated brutally, but then to see this 75-year-old white man be treated just as brutally,
that
like
resonated.
Maybe for them, it really hits home finally. But the reality is, like, you know what, just because you have you know, when you have brutality against even a small segment of your population, it doesn't matter. The fact that it can happen mm-hmm. means it can happen to anybody, right? And I think people's motivation should be, I mean, sure, like, fine if it's just for yourself, you know, like you're self-interested, but like generally in society, we shouldn't allow anyone in our society, right, mm-hmm. to be more subjected to things that are brutal or unfair. And, you know, like it's not okay no matter who it happens to. But correct. I guess in some cases, if it takes them witnessing somebody who they can relate more to in order to actually have empathy for the whole cause, I guess better late than never.
Well, but, sure.
Yeah. But no, I mean, I get but that's point. It. Like, I think as a society, you know, we have to worry about the fact that any kind of, you know, brutality or tyranny or whatever happens. Actually, a parallel to that is when in the U.S., when the protests following George Floyd's killing happened, and suddenly the cops were turning against the media, right? Like you were seeing all these media people getting
pummeled. The female journalist got shot in the face.
And shot at with rubber bullets and other tear gas and things like that. And then people were like, wait a sec, now they're attacking the media? Like, what the heck? And it's like, that's terrible too. And it's not that the media is more precious than, you know, other people like the protesters, but the point is, it just goes to show that, yeah, you know what, just because when you have brutality against one group of people, it's never just confined to that. It will go bigger. There and that's what we saw in the States. Right?
There is, I have a quick example of that. There is a relative of the family who is a journalist who lives in Tampa Bay in the United States and writes for the paper down there, the Tampa Bay Tribune, I believe is the name. And she and her, another journalist from the newspaper, who's a white male, were arrested during a protest. And they let him go. The police released him pretty much immediately, but mm-hmm. removed the handcuffs off her and put on those plastic ties behind her back. And the reasons was she didn't look like a reporter. She's just a short, dark Indian woman, right? And the mayor had to apologize for what happened. The police chiefs had to apologize. Mm. She showed her ID. They still didn't believe that she was who she claimed to be and who she actually was. So there you have
it. That CNN reporter too, who was holding his badge and he still got arrested.
And he just happened to be a black reporter, right? He got arrested. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you see examples of, like you mentioned, police being shot at. There's a female reporter who was a freelancer for The Guardian. People in the media, sorry. Yeah. And was shot and is now blind in her left eye.
It's so brutal, yeah.
And now you're having, and typically we see this stuff in dictatorships. Let's be clear. When people,
it's true. Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It is, you know what, it's a slippery slope. And I think if now is the time, like, I hope this is actually going to be a turning point. Like, it's definitely led to a lot more intense scrutiny of those who are in positions of power. And I hope that it will lead to meaningful change. But, you know, I suppose people might have thought that after the riots, the Rodney King incident, years ago, right? So maybe people thought that would have been a turning point. It wasn't like a huge turning point, right? And so I don't know. I mean, I'm sort of cautiously optimistic/skeptical about how this is all going to unfold over the next little while. But I do think that, you know, these are issues that people need to really think about. And we do need to hold those in power to account. Because the one thing I do see, you know, like whenever in society we have allowed certain people to have power, whether it's the police, it's the judiciary, it's, you know, wherever else, right? That there can be, that there will be those who will abuse their power and those who unwittingly will also use their privilege in ways that are harmful to others. And I think it's important for us to be, to recognize that and to try to find ways to minimize and to have checks and balances against abuses of power and use of privilege in a way that harms other people.
I can't add anything more to that. I mean, I'd basically be repeating what you've said, but yeah, I mean,
let's so just... then shall we move to the fails of the week? Because it's like, I think we could probably keep going on.
I know we could. We could. Yeah. I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff, but we'll just be retreading what we've gone over with more examples. We all know racism exists. We all know how it manifests itself. The issue is, like, how do you stamp it out? And what actions do what people have to take to ensure? Yeah. I have no doubt that we are going to see more incidents going forward. But what I am hopeful is that the response of society level, like, causes that rate of incident to go down, where people
agree
to check the
and have, like, structural change. Like, I think there has to be political will. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that, at least in Canada and in some pockets in the US, that there is that political will. But it also underscores the point of, you know, it matters who you elect. If we had had the Conservative Party in power, I don't think they would have really cared as much. I mean, they're paying lip service to the issue now because it suits them politically. But I don't believe that they would be any better to take care of things. So, you know, in a way, I'm kind of glad that it is Justin Trudeau and at least some on his team. I can't say that I believe that everyone on the Liberal team is equally as on board with that agenda. I'm sure no one would outwardly say anything against it, but I do have good reason to believe that not everybody on in cabinet strongly believes that this is an important issue to address. But I do believe that there are some who, and many possibly.
I think you're right on. I think you're right.
Yeah. So, so at least from the federal side of things, you know, like I feel like, okay, if you guys, given that I genuinely believe that you genuinely want to do something about it, if you guys don't do anything about it, that will be a huge disappointment. So, you know, I think there needs to be political will, but I think there also needs to be individual responsibility in calling it out when you see it, and not just those who are Black or Indigenous or people of color who should be calling it out, but those who benefit from the privileges that are out there, that when they see it, when they hear it in their families, in their circles, they should walk away and say something and walk away to let people know it's not okay. And to educate people, to educate their kids, to know that, you know what, this is not okay. So I think with that mindset, hopefully, you know, we'll have actual change down the road, but probably it'll take a lot longer than we would like it to happen. So anyways, let's move to the fails. Why don't you start with your political fail of the week?
You gave me a lead-in to my political fail of the week.
Yes, that was on purpose. No, it wasn't. I have no idea what your political fail is. Okay, so go ahead.
Andrew Scheer, a complete coward. I'll tell you why I say that and why he's the political fail. He stated, I quote, "Trudeau's government has done nothing to clear the backlog for years." Scheer added that if Trudeau is admitting there is systematic racism in the RCMP, he must take responsibility and act to address it. Okay, fair enough. Moving along, on CTV, Andrew Scheer won't say if systematic racism exists in the RCMP.
See? Right.
Which is it? Right?
I mean,
can you take a position? I would rather you say it doesn't exist than take this position. Because nothing good or purposeful is coming out of a flip-floppy type of series of statements here. If you believe...
Yeah, it's a contradictory...
It is. It is position, absolutely farcical.
But you know what I think happened there? I think someone wrote his tweet for him, and he had no idea that they were even making that attack. And so then when he was, you know, talking about not really thinking there was systematic or systemic racism in the RCMP, that he just was maybe representing more closer to what his actual view is. But that's beside the point. The point there is that this actually shows just this issue and many issues that people care about are just important to them for political gains.
Right.
There's not a genuine position there. Yeah.
I mean, I would shudder to ask the other leadership contenders of the Conservative Party of Canada their position based on this. And I'm going to leave it there because this is just nuts. So why don't you go to your media fail of the week and see.
Okay, so I'm going to take us away from this issue to the other big issue that is engulfing us in 2020, and that is the pandemic. So the media recently has criticized the Prime Minister for being out and about sort of for being contradictory, sending contradictory messages, because, you know, he's not proponent of resuming full parliament, yet he's out and about in the community, going to different factories and, you know, going to the Black Lives Matters protest and taking a knee and so on. So he's visible in the community, yet he thinks it's not safe enough for parliament to operate fully. And so, you know, that's a problem. But the thing there is, like, you know, people are kind of being unfair to the prime minister in the sense that he is being criticized for not doing enough and then doing too much and, you know, hiding in his cottage, which is not what he's doing. But he, you know, he's decided that he wants to use this this pandemic as an opportunity to speak directly to Canadians regularly, if like almost daily, because it's comforting to some Canadians to have the PM come out during this unprecedented time in our lifetimes and to speak to us about like, what is the government doing and where are we at and what do we need to do and all those things, right? And so I just feel like it's a bit of an unfair criticism because I do think that the PM and his team are still paying a lot of attention to the safety aspect. I think it's genuine. You know, when he is out and about, he is wearing a mask, right? And the majority of the staffers are still working from home. The civil servants mostly are still working from home. So I don't think the government is being reckless on health and thus, you know, they're being hypocritical by having him go out and, you know, meet with some companies that are doing, that have sort of shifted gears to like come up with PPE and that sort of thing. So I don't think he's being, I don't think he's being hypocritical. I think he's trying to do his job, you know, the best that he can within the constraints that we all have right now. And I just feel like the media's job should not be to, you know, just like make these like lowbrow attacks. Like, it's just such a stupid thing to attack them for.
Dealing with the same, look, first point for me is like, it's catch 22 for him. If he goes out, he's going to be chastised because Parliament's not sitting. If he doesn't come and talk, he's not providing enough information. So he's damned either way. And that's just, no, that's just a fact of life for him.
Absolutely.
And it's counterproductive.
The thing about the Parliament thing is like, they have been operating. Like, they're not just sitting at home and having a grand vacation. Like, they are operating. I mean, the government is doing so much right now.
Well, Michelle Rempel is, but let's not go there.
Right? Yes, our Oklahoma MP.
Oklaberta. She's from Oklaberta.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. I think, personally, I don't see the point of the MPs all gathering in Parliament, in the House of Commons and giving each other, you know, a virus potentially. Mm-hmm. I think it's more important that they find other ways of operating, like most businesses have been trying to do, and you know, to actually focus on substance over style, right? Like, to me, there's nothing to be added to them coming into the House in person, all of them, because it's just too risky and it doesn't actually help make a difference to the substance. And actually, I think what the Conservatives are proposing is that we have a reduced number of MPs in the House.
Don't
we
already?
Which is kind of what you're getting in a way, right? But the problem is they don't want the virtual thing because the thing there is the virtual thing allows those who are further away to participate. So I think that's actually better democracy to have the hybrid version that they have right now. But anyways, the reality when it comes to the Conservatives' critique and sometimes the media's critique is it's nonsensical in a lot of cases.
I like to call it puerile for one reason. You're dealing with the same media that ran crazy with the video of Bolsonaro allegedly ignoring Trudeau, the president of Brazil, right? It turned out to be nonsense. Right. So, I mean, that's what you're dealing with.
It was doctored, yeah,
right.
Exactly.
You know, we can get mad and upset, but they're going to do it and they're going to keep doing it because people get attracted by it. So we go.
So do you have any fact or fictions?
I do. They relate to what we're discussing today, sadly. Okay. But these are data and information that I think people need to know and should know. And it's stuff that we bring up in lecture just to reinforce the point of systematic discrimination and whatnot. Mm. So here's a question for you. When it comes to incarceration levels in Canada, in Canadian prisons, more than 30% of inmates are Indigenous. Fact or fiction?
More than 30%, you said, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's fact.
You are completely correct. That is fact. And here's the point that makes this 30% so disturbing. Do you know what percentage Indigenous people are of the total Canadian population?
Yeah, it's low. I think it's less than 5%.
it is approximately 5%. So 5% of the population comprises 30% of the prison population.
It's disproportionate.
That you cannot, you can, I have heard so many, and you can think of these arguments in your own terms. I have heard so many intellectually immoral and unbalanced arguments as to why Aboriginals make up a high proportion.
Indigenous people.
Yeah, it does not stand any reason whatsoever. So that's the first one. So you got that one right. Here's one, we'll go to the United States. We'll take a look at what's going on there. African Americans are incarcerated at more than 5 times the rate of whites.
Yeah, true.
That is true. And here's the kicker. They also, if you combine African Americans, this is a number that is very disturbing. When you combine the populations of African Americans, Hispanics, it makes up around 32% of the American population, but it comprises close to 60% of the incarceration.
So it's sad, very shocking and sad.
Right. We can't say this is just, you know, just is what it is. It's not. There are many other factors at play, and you know, we can take a look at the first the data I gave to you on the Indigenous peoples that was released by the federal watchdog, and the second was from the NAACP, who produce a lot of good work on that. So those are the two factor fictions for this week.
Well, I think that's good food for thought for this episode. We don't know yet what our next topic will be for the next episode of Matter of Fact, but hope you'll tune in when we're back with the next episode. Until then, take care.
This is fun! The FU Network.